Journey, Don't Stop Believing on BBC Radio London. Welcome along to the show. It's Shay Court Gutterfall. Quite an interesting conversation that I've been having today. And it's around culture. You know, sometimes we can confuse identity with culture, but whether or not a person can own a culture, or, you know, how you manage to learn to understand a culture that is different to your own. Of course, it's vitally important, isn't it? But then there is a key difference, and this has been a big debate in recent years around cultural appreciation versus cultural appropriation. Well, these are some of the topics in the new book, which releases tomorrow, titled Culture, A New World History. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by the author, Harvard academic Martin Puckner, a little bit to discuss the book, but also his perspective on cultures. Martin, great to have you in the show. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Shay.
Firstly, congratulations on the book. It's quite a read, it must be said. But I'd like to start off first just finding out a bit more about yourself. Where did your fascination just for understanding cultures come about?
You know, maybe from the fact that I've grown up, I grew up in Germany, I moved to Italy, I lived in the States, I travel a lot.
So you're a global person. You're a global guy.
in some ways. I mean, yeah. I think we've all become global in one way or another, true, whether we move around a lot or not.
Yes.
But I think I try to sort of make sense of that experience. And that's how I came to the topic.
When we talk about, because I was intrigued by the title, it says Culture, A New World History. Important, I guess, why you've chosen those particular words, because for many of us, when we look at the world and we look at history and the discussion of history, oftentimes, as we know, history is written by the victors. And so when you say a new world history, is it really looking at it through that lens of getting a more understanding, a cultural context of history, not just from the emperors or the colonizers or whatever it may be?
I think that's exactly right. So I focus, every chapter is sort of about a person or an object.
Yes.
Like, for example, there's this tiny little statue that was found in Pompeii, preserved when the volcano erupted. That's from South Asia. And so there is, you know, suddenly you realize Rome didn't just borrow from Greece or from Egypt. We knew that, but had this vital exchange with South Asia. So that's maybe one tiny tidbit from it.
I think there is so many, because I was really intrigued by that. Obviously, as you can tell, I'm South Asian. And so, yes, I may have a personal bias learning more about kind of, you know, the South Asian community, what it's like. But also, most people wouldn't even think of that, would they? As you mentioned, a South Asian goddess in Pompeii. But then at the same time, in chapter one, you talk about Queen Nefertiti and her faceless god. You've really delved into a lot of the key histories that are taught in our textbooks here in the UK. That, you know, students, children will learn about, whether it is Egypt or the Greeks or the Romans. But actually, and the fact is, what you're saying is how interconnected some of those worlds really are and those cultures really are.
That's right. And, you know, since you mentioned Nefertiti, you know, everyone has, you know, people know that face, that beautiful statue that's now in Berlin. But the story behind her is fascinating. And I didn't know that she basically invented a whole new type of religion, a kind of precursor to monotheism.
Wow.
So this was a remarkable experiment, a cultural experiment that was then erased from history by subsequent dynasties and had to be elaborately excavated in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Thing is, I was quite taken by, in your preface, you started off, and this is what I was thinking about, you know, discussing culture and what it means, because it sometimes many people will get confused just by the definition. So you've gone slap bang straight into it, right? Where you say how culture works. Here's one view of culture. The earth is populated by groups of humans, and these groups are held together by shared practices. You then go on to say this view assumes that culture is a form of property, that culture belongs to the people who live it. So then is your book, therefore, really looking at it to actually say, actually, no, that's not oftentimes the case. Even if people feel culture belongs to the people who live it, it's a wider global view that we need to have.
I think that's very nicely put. If you look at any given tradition and you scratch the surface, you realize it's made up of bits and pieces from other traditions. It's sort of cultural borrowing all the way down.
Sure.
Now, I totally get people who are worried about cultural appropriation. I think they worry about facile or disrespectful uses of other culture, or actually, you know, theft, especially in a colonial context, of objects. And so obviously I'm not for these things.
Okay.
But the only thing that worries me is that sometimes the attempt to avoid these, you know, facile views of other cultures makes that assumption that culture is property. And I think that's wrong if you look at the deep history. And my worry is that if you think too much of culture as property, then we deprive ourselves of that immense resource that's cultural borrowing. So let's avoid these disrespectful uses, but let's articulate that differently than through this idea that this is my culture, this is yours, hands off, and we'll just each stay in our own lane.
So it's a very contentious conversation that you're having, you know, Martin, sat here in London, in United Kingdom, when we talk about the British and, you know, many communities, including myself, that are a byproduct of colonialization and what that means. I mean, growing up, I used to love the whole discussion around social anthropology. And I feel some of what you're talking about comes onto that topic. But let's bring it to present day, shall we? Only a couple of weeks ago, it was in international news. Everyone was talking about the controversial Kohinoor diamond not being used in the coronation. That's what Buckingham Palace, of course, have said. It's been controversial for the fact that there's this dispute of the ownership of Kohinoor. And for anyone who's tuning in who doesn't know, just to kind of give it a brief, it's one of the largest cut diamonds in the world. And there's always been concerns around this diplomatic row of India and the UK and whether it should or should not be used. But then here you are saying is we kind of shouldn't look at things as being owned by any one culture. I wonder what your take is on that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm obviously not for the theft of cultural objects like Benin statues. You know, there's a lot of talk about returning those. I'm all for that.
Okay.
But I feel like the goal can't be that everything just returns to where it came from.
Okay.
And then we are done. I feel like that's when it gets really interesting. So I'm all for returning some of these objects that are acquired under dubious circumstances.
You'd end up empty in British Museum, wouldn't you?
True.
Come on.
But then in a second step, I think we should actually have more circulation of these objects, not less.
Like being loaned by countries or something like that.
Loaned, you know, send it back. Let's send a couple of turners back as well. Let's get something in return.
Okay.
Let's come up with schemes of loaning so that actually more people get exposed to more rather than less, rather than just returning.
So do you know what? This debate, it's really divisive, isn't it? And I appreciate with your book, you have gone back to basics, the fundamentals, as I've just mentioned, whether we're looking at, you know, Egypt, you know, the Greeks, the Romans, that kind of stuff. But if we bring it a bit more to present day, I am fascinated with this conversation being second generation British Punjabi. You know, my father used to tell me of a time where, you know, family members in India would have been absolutely horrified that I was saying British rather than Indian, you know, because of that colonial history. And when we talk about, as you mentioned, cultural appropriation, cultural appreciation, how do we bring it to present day? You know, there's oftentimes, I used this example earlier in the show, and I use it because I wanted to ask you. There was a huge debate online, I remember this, when particular coffee chains in the UK started to do turmeric lattes. And, you know, the South Asians were like, oh, if you're going to appropriate, at least appreciate and call it healthy. You know, for centuries upon centuries, communities have talked about the powers of turmeric. And it's very distinct within the South Asian community. I just wonder where you stand on that conversation when you talk about a new world history.
Well, you know, it's a great example. I love it. And of course, I don't think we need to endorse every silly form of cultural borrowing. There are lots of differences we can make, lots of distinctions we can make, mistakes, we can point out mistakes, we can point out misunderstandings. But I think what's the principle on which we base this? I think the principle has to be still better forms of circulation, better forms of cultural borrowing, rather than no circulation or no borrowing. You know, the book ends with a few pages yes. on K-pop, and that's another good example. It's such a fusion kind of, you know, pop phenomenon.
Yeah, Korean pop. Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, I'm staying in Whitechapel right now, and yes. there's a K-pop store that I just walked by.
Yes, yes. My niece is hooked on it, honestly. Trust me, I know about it. But that, do you think that's the modern day version? Is that what you're talking about in terms of
exactly.
cultural appreciation?
Exactly. And it also, because it also shows that, of course, we, you know, culture now circulates so
yes.
fast through the internet. And
yes.
and of course, that also means that certain forms of culture don't lend themselves as well to this kind of super fast YouTube, TikTok kind of circulation. So again, I'm not saying this is all great,
mm-hmm.
but I'm saying it is borrowing all the way down. We can't close our eyes to that. And so once we accept that, then we can start to have a conversation about
sure.
which kinds of borrowing do we want.
Got you. Now, the book is called Culture, A New World History. It's out. It's available tomorrow. People can follow you as well, can't they, Martin? What's your Twitter?
Martin_Puckner.
And it's P-U-C-H-N-E-R, Martin_Puckner. And they can go to the website, martinpuckner.com. I want to ask you, aside from the book now, because I know we've delved into that, is there a culture that has always fascinated you, that you really, even perhaps writing this book or just in your personal life, have been intrigued by it? And what culture is that specifically? And like, you know, maybe you just gravitate towards it and it's something you've learned so much about.
Well, I'll give you a slightly different example.
Go on.
Namely, a culture that I learned about, not growing up, but uh-huh. more recently, and a cultural object that I didn't know existed, and I think that's completely underappreciated, and that's the Kebra Nagast. It's the Ethiopian scribal text, and it's a wild, fascinating text. It achieved its current form in the 14th century. It tells a story of the Queen of Sheba.
Uh-huh.
visiting King Solomon in Jerusalem, having a son by him, ultimately stealing the Ten Commandments and bringing them to Aksum in Ethiopia, and starting basically that object becomes the beginning of Ethiopian Christianity.
Okay.
So it's a wild story of cultural borrowing, even theft,
uh-huh.
that became a central text for Ethiopian Christianity, and then in the 20th century became central for the Rastafari movement in Jamaica. So, you know, a wild story from Jerusalem to Ethiopia to Jamaica. And that's just a story that I think should be much better known.
Okay.
And that has captivated me ever since I came across it
right.
about 15 years ago.
Yeah, but these are the kind of, you know, world histories, basically, aren't they, that we're not necessarily too aware of. And you've mentioned that it's not something I myself have a lot of knowledge of. And that's obviously why we have you writing these books, Culture, A New World History. From your conclusion, having done this research with this book, do you fundamentally believe, therefore, that no one society can take ownership over a culture? Or does religion have a part to play? You know, because there will be particular communities, particular world religions that feel they have ownership of a particular culture with the language, with the communities and the way that they work.
Maybe, you know, it's a good, this conversation makes me realize that maybe we should think about what it means to say we have ownership.
Sure.
I feel like communities make certain traditions their own. And I think that's great. You make something your own by spending a lot of time with it, by admiring it, by immersing yourself in something. And this is what communities do.
Mm.
But a lot of communities have, you know, go to in several directions. You can have two forms of culture or
yeah.
three. And so I think it's not so much we share everything and everything is everything.
Yeah.
No, you know, you make something your own. It means something important to you, including religion. And there are lots of stories of religion, the spread of Buddhism and so on and so forth.
Sure.
So I very much include religion. So I suppose I would say that I'm not against ownership in that sense of making something your own.
Yeah.
It's more worries me when you say, you know, hands off, this is mine and it's not yours.
Yeah,
that
I mean,
form of ownership.
So it's an interesting one. And I only ask you this in the context of borders. They're man-made, you know. And so I come from the Punjabi community. And Punjab was split in half during the partition of India, half of it to Pakistan, half of it to India. But of course, if you cross the border, like I have, and it always struck me as a young girl when I would leave my grandfather, who was originally born in Lahore, due to partition, had to go to India, was never allowed back into Pakistan. I, his British granddaughter, could go from India, cross the border, go to Pakistan. But the part that I went to Lahore, they were speaking the same language as he was. They were eating the same food. They were living the same life. They were wearing the same clothes. And that there is a visual representation, is it not, of how borders, culture, community transcend borders, is what I'm saying.
Exactly. And that borders in many ways are, as you say, they are man-made, they are artificial artifacts that try to stop the movement of people, of culture. And ultimately, fortunately, they are not very good at that.
Yes. You know,
because borders, all borders are porous. And your story is an example of that.
It's always struck, stayed with me, that I must say. I absolutely love the book. William Dalrymple says, a writer of genius. Clearly, you've done a lot of work. How long did it take you to get into this book, I must ask?
Well, the research was, of course, many years in a very collaborative project. I actually wrote it during COVID. And so, you know, it's one of those.
Had ample time. So you're like, right, I've got the laptop. I can now put this research into good use. Let's get a book out of it.
Exactly. Ample time and the fantasy. If only I could go to all of these places all over the world. But of course, I couldn't. I was stuck at home.
That's the beauty of books, isn't it? It takes you there. Martin, a real pleasure having you on Radio London. It's quite an important conversation. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Martin Puckner there. The name of the book, Culture and New World History. Go to that website, martinpuckner.com, for further details.
When you first left me, I was wanting more. But you were that girl next door. What'd you do that for? What'd you do that for? When you first left me, I didn't know what to say. I never been on my own that way. Just sat by myself all day. From my friends, I found a light in the tunnel at the end. Now you're calling me up on the phone, so you can have a little wine and a moan. It's only because you're feeling alone. At first, when I see you cry, yeah, it makes me smile. Yeah, it makes me smile. At worst, I feel bad for a while.
Alan Smile on BBC Radio London. Welcome along to the show. It's Shay Corgodaval here with you till 6 p.m. Oh, goodness, it's flying by, isn't it, today? It's always the case, I've got to say, though, the show does just fly by. Now, if you'd like to get involved with the conversation, 0800 731 2000. Been talking a lot about water fountains. What's your take on water fountains? Are you somebody who uses them? Are you somebody, perhaps, who would welcome more of them? Victorian era drinking fountains are being restored across London. Well, would you use them? This is what a lot of people had to say today.
I feel like there's a problem, you know, not nip over to the nearest vendor just to buy a plastic water bottle. So it would encourage me to do it anyway.
Yeah.
Would encourage you as well?
Yeah.
It's all helpful, isn't it? The more places that you can fill up without having to buy, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Would you use this fountain if it was working?
I used to, actually, about 40 years ago.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's been quite a while, but it's still quite nice looking, so yeah, it should be all right.
So would you, I'm continuing that conversation, would you use a public water fountain if they were more available? 0800